Table. Thank you to each of you for being here this morning. It's been several years since I've been able to be at the Range Beef Cow Symposium. It's good to be back here today. Just like to thank the committee for inviting me to be here, and also like to thank whoever was in charge of the weather. Pretty nice traveling weather and pretty nice weather today, so I hope it holds out, and do appreciate that. So this morning, I've been asked to talk a little bit about crossbreeding. And this is probably one of the topics that's been talked about more here than probably maybe any others. And so a little bit of a daunting task there. So one thing that I think about is that when we think about crossbreeding, I've seen it written and I've seen it, I've heard it said, it's a little bit like good intentions. Not carried out as one might want it to be. And so as I think about that and as I consider that, what I come away with is that I think that we know that crossbreeding might be something that's good for us, but maybe it's not being implemented quite the way we would like it to be, or maybe the way it should be. And so today, just in terms of kind of what we'll go through, a little bit of introduction, and then following that, a little bit about some reasons for crossbreeding, and all of you are pretty much aware of those things, but we'll kind of talk through those and maybe discuss a few things a little bit differently, get everybody kind of on the same page, then some systems as well as some impacts of crossbreeding. So to begin with, I'll just talk here a little bit about some data from the Beef Improvement Federation meetings in Colorado in 2007. At those meetings, there were about 400 or 500 people, similar to what's here today, that were in attendance. And as a part of that meeting, they used those clickers, the clicker technology, student response system type things, and asked the audience a number of questions about where they thought the industry was going and what would be good for the industry in the future. And so some of those questions were geared towards crossbreeding. And so as you look here on the screen, you can see that the first question that was asked, or one of the questions that was asked, was the ideal beef cow will be crossbred. And so in excess of 70% of those respondents said that the ideal beef cow should be crossbred. Then when you look down there at the bottom, the ideal market steer for feedlot profitability will be crossbred, again in excess of 70%, almost 80%. And then the ideal market steer for overall carcass value will be crossbred, again in the 70s. So as I think about that, I think it's clear that a lot of people in the industry recognize the value and the benefits of crossbreeding. So the question becomes, is that really what we see out there in the industry? And so to kind of follow that up, we can look at the National Animal Health Monitoring System Survey and look at that 2007 calf crop, same year that those responses were taken. And what you see here is if you can see it broken down into number of cows. And all the way across on the far right, you can see all operations. And then you can see it broken down, purebred, composite, crossbreed of two breeds, and crossbreed of three breeds. Bottom line is that you see there those purebred animals, 15.3%. So from the National Animal Health Monitoring System survey, about 85% of the calf crop that was reported that year was crossbred or had some crossbreeding influence. So kind of matches up with those numbers that were there at the Beef Improvement Federation meeting. So then we can also continue to look and see what's shown in terms of actual cows. And you can see here in terms of, in that same survey, the majority of beef cows. And in these bars on the far left, you can see purebred or straightbred, 17.5%. So about 83% crossbred cows. So I think when we look at those numbers, it kind of matches up pretty well. I kind of wonder what you're thinking. Is that really how it was then? Do you believe those numbers? Is that how maybe you reported it if you were asked to be a part of that NOM survey? And kind of where we are today, or kind of what the trends look like now. So Every once in a while, Beef Magazine does a survey, and in that survey they look at production characteristics as well as genetic trends and things such as that. And so to see if we've kind of gone and continued in that trend of importance with regard to crossbreeding, you can look here that in 2010, the top two groups there, high percent purebred British, high percent purebred Continental, kind of considered those purebred animals, and then the last three there are crossbreds. So about 35% or so crossbred animals, or that reported to be producing crossbred animals. So quite a difference from what we might have seen in 2007 to 2010, and then you look to 2014 and the numbers get a little bit worse with regard to crossbreeding. So the question is, maybe how many might be crossbreeding today? And if we're not crossbreeding in commercial herds, then maybe what are some of the reasons for that? And we'll kind of talk about some of those things as we continue forward. So there's no question that everybody, probably everybody in the room, has heard the reasons for crossbreeding or the advantages of crossbreeding or the benefits of crossbreeding, one of which is heterosis. And when we think about heterosis, it's just the percentage or the performance advantage of crossbreds compared to the average of the straight-bred parents. So sometimes when people think about this definition or what crossbreeding and heterosis really kind of includes, or how to compare that, sometimes they begin looking at those crossbred animals and maybe considering those breeds that went into that crossbreed. And as they do that, they might find that some of those animals, maybe those straightbreds are outperformed, or those crossbreds are outperformed by one or the other of those parent breeds. But it's important that we consider that this is the average. We compare to the average of those straightbred parents. Then another thing to think about here is with regard to heterosis, that improvement in performance is only available when we cross breeds, not within a breed. So if we want to take advantage of that, we need to make sure and use crossbreeding and get that extra advantage in terms of performance for the traits of economic importance in our beef cattle operations. The other thing that we might look at here in terms of heterosis, a number of different types of heterosis, some listed there, individual or direct, maternal and paternal. And we'll see some examples and the magnitude of those on a couple of other slides. But another thing that I'll just mention here is that the level of heterosis is really determined by the degree of genetic difference between those breeds. So as we think about that, there's oftentimes the case that we go out and we decide we might be in a crossbreeding program, and we try to find animals or breeds that are somewhat similar to the ones that we're currently raising in an effort maybe to be a little more uniform as those calves are produced or whatever the case may be. But as those animals or as those breeds are genetically similar, we're going to decrease the amount of heterosis that we could get from those crosses. So to get the maximum percent heterosis, and if you want to calculate it down at the bottom, kind of like those kind of equations and things such as that, so I left that with you there. But one of the things is that we want to make sure that there's differences between those breeds and they're genetically dissimilar so that we can capture that level of heterosis. So you can see here on the graph or on the table some differences or the different levels of heterosis for various traits. And here we're looking at individual heterosis or direct heterosis. And you can see the advantages of those crossbred calves. And so as we look there, you can see in calving rate about 3.2 percentage improvement, survival to weaning about 1.4%, and then down at the bottom some growth traits, weaning weight, average daily gain, and yearling weight, and all of those have different levels of heterosis and different levels of improvement with regard to those trait units. So that's one type of heterosis. And as you kind of look down that list there, kind of keep in mind the different types of traits that are listed and maybe the groupings or characterization of those traits, because we'll kind of categorize those a little bit later and talk about them in a little more detail. Another study here just shows the advantage of those crossbred calves or that direct heterosis for some carcass traits. And you can see here that those carcass trait, the level of heterosis with regard to carcass traits is lower than some of those that we saw on the previous slide. Then, as we go to the advantage of that crossbred dam, that crossbred cow that's out there on the range or on our farms and ranches, you can see there that there is advantage to that crossbred animal in terms of calving rate, survival to weaning, birth weight, weaning weight, and longevity. And all of those, again, have different levels of improvement with regard to those trait units. And then over there on the far right, you can see that the percent heterosis ranges anywhere from about 3.7% up to, in terms of longevity, 16.2%, which is almost a year and a half in terms of longevity. And some of our speakers have already mentioned this morning how important that is to a ranch or to an operation's bottom line. If we're keeping those animals in the herd longer and not having to replace them, there's less cost to the operation. And so when we see those lower costs, then hopefully we're getting more income. And then down at the bottom there, cow lifetime production. When we think about the amount of improvement that we see from crossbred cows, about almost a full calf in terms of those crossbred dams, and a cumulative weaning weight of 600 pounds. So I ask that you kind of keep in mind the different types or the different characterization or categorization of those traits. And as we think about those traits, one thing that we can consider with regard to heterosis is also in regard to the heritability of those traits. When we think about the heritability, that just is explained by or defined by, heritability is the measure of the amount of variation in the traits that's due to genetics. And so as we look at those different traits, reproduction, growth, and carcass merit or carcass traits, we can see that the heritabilities go from low to high. When we compare that to the percent heterosis that's seen in those traits, it kind of goes in the opposite direction or an inverse direction. So the inverse, there is an inverse relationship between the heritability of those traits and the level of heterosis for those traits. So what that tells us there is that those traits, such as reproduction, that aren't controlled quite as much by genetics and more so are affected by environment and non-genetic factors, that we have difficulty sometimes in improving those traits through direct selection. But we can make improvements in those traits if we use crossbreeding, because we can improve those through heterosis and gene combinations, non-additive type genetics, versus in terms of heritability where that would be low, direct selection or additive genetics there. And then we look there at carcass merit, high heritabilities, where we can change those pretty rapidly or readily through selection, and there is not very much heterosis that we see in those types of traits. So the other reason maybe that we are most known or that's most known to us with regard to reasons to crossbreed would be breed complementarity. And as we think about breed complementarity, I just go kind of to the second bullet there to begin with. And I guess I'm kind of in the camp that I don't think that there's any one breed that really fits every situation that we have out there. As you think about beef cattle being raised all across the United States, there's a lot of different production scenarios, production environments, marketing situations, management situations, and all of those. And I really don't believe that there's any one breed that fits every one of those situations. And so as we think about that, then there are breeds out there that have some attributes that are favorable to us and maybe some that are not favorable. So as we think about breed complementarity, then we're kind of thinking about the combination of breeds that excel in different characteristics. So a classic example would be that as we think about cattle being raised in the southern part of the United States, maybe the deep south or the southwest, that those animals down there experience quite a different environment than they might here, or maybe in Idaho where I currently live. And so as a result of that, we have to find some animals that have some traits that they can withstand those heat temperatures, that can withstand the humidity, pest, and those kinds of things. And so that Brahman cross with some of our British breeds, we get the carcass traits and some of the growth traits from those British breeds or continental breeds, and then we get some of those other attributes from Brahman breeds down south. So the last thing I'll just say here, several years ago, going through some maybe old Beef Improvement Federation meeting proceedings, I found this, and I use it in class sometimes, about the definition for breed complementarity. And it was given by Tom Cartwright from Texas A&M back in the 70s. And I guess he found it in Webster, but it says, serving to fill out or complete, mutually supplying each other's lack. So again, just the definition there tells us that as we think about breeds and breed complementarity, there's really not one that serves all of our purposes. So there are going to be those breeds that have some areas that need to be filled, and there's going to be those that lack something. And so as we look to those different breeds, hopefully we can find the types of breeds that fill the deficits in some of those others. So as we continue to think a little bit here about breed complementarity, I think one of the things that's pretty important is that we have some means to look at or some means to evaluate how those breeds perform in the various traits. And so we have to look at that from time to time and actually see how they are and if they are excelling in the traits that we're in need of. So as we think about that, you can look here, and there's several different graphs here. I think I have birth weight, weaning weight, yearling weight, and milk. But what you see here is for the top seven or most highly used breeds that what's listed here on the slide is kind of the crossbreed adjusted EPDs or genetic trend for those seven breeds from way back in the 70s up until about 2014. And so as you look at that, just here in terms of birth weight, I think what you see is quite a bit of variation over there on your left side. And then as we come to the right side of that graph, they kind of come closer together. And the trend generally here is that we know that increased birth weights do cause some difficulty for us. And so over time, there's been work to kind of moderate birth weight, keep it in check, at least not let it rise too much. And so you can kind of see how that's happened over time. If we compare that with our growth traits, such as weaning weight and yearling weight, we'll see a little different story. You can see that as we go from the left to the right, that pretty much all of those breeds have kind of increased in terms of their genetic trend for weaning weight and are kind of getting a little more similar. And so we'll talk a little bit about them getting a little more similar in just a minute, but you can see there kind of how those different breeds have kind of changed over time with regard to weaning weight. So as you think about weaning weight here, I think you'd expect yearling weight to be somewhat the same. And as you look there, that is the case. We see an increase from left to right. And over the years, we've seen a work in most breeds to try and improve growth traits, get more pounds on the ground to sell. So as a result of that, then you see those trends going up. And the other thing, you see maybe a little less variation on the right compared to the left between those breeds. So maybe those breeds are getting a little more similar than they once were. And maybe even some of those breeds that maybe we thought weren't maybe very good for yearling weight growth, and maybe if we're thinking of this as a proxy maybe for mature weight, that if we thought maybe they were a little bit moderate size, that now as we look at that, maybe that's changed a little bit. Then the last one that I leave you with here is just milk. And you can kind of see how things have changed. The breeds have kind of changed rank and some things such as that over time. But again, by looking at graphs such as this and really understanding the trends of those breeds and kind of looking at where those breeds rank compared to one another, we can find breeds that then help us in terms of breed complementarity, one breed filling the lack of another breed. So when we do talk about breed complementarity, I think just like we've mentioned so far, that it's pretty important that we try and identify the proper breeds. And as we think about those proper breeds, some of the things that we should consider are things such as our production and marketing objectives. What are our goals for our operation and how are we going to get there? So we have to determine what is the desired level of performance for those traits of economic importance in our own operations. And then as we look at that, are the breeds that we currently have, are the breeds that we're currently using, do they meet those targets? And then another thing that we have to consider, where are we going to find those replacements that we use? Are we going to produce them on our own, or maybe are we going to purchase them somewhere? And then the last thing is a little bit about markets for those calves. How are we going to market those calves and what are the constraints on the markets or from the marketplace? And are we able to find those breeds, mix those breeds together that fit those market constraints? And then as we think back and look at maybe milk, there's no question that as we think about milk or really any of the traits, that as we select animals to put in those operations, in those situations, we want to provide them with an environment that allows them to reach their genetic potential. And so we have to evaluate that production environment and make sure that the resources are there so that those animals do have the opportunity to perform and provide what we would like them to in terms of their characteristics. And then the last thing here I'll just mention is a little bit about dam lines and maternal or sire lines, maternal and paternal. I think that it's pretty important that we find ways to get our cows to match the environment. And as we do that, and as they do match the environment, then they can perform well in that environment. They can reach their genetic potential. They can produce calves that fit the environment. But then if the market constraints change, or if we want to hit a particular market or a particular kind of goal, we can then use a terminal cross or paternal line that then allows us to do that. So we're trying to match the cows to an environment and match the cows to the market through breed complementarity. So before I go on, I think I just think a little bit about maybe some reasons over the years that people have mentioned why they don't crossbreed, or maybe some reasons that I've seen. Some of the reasons that have been noted are things such as some of the systems of crossbreeding are too complex for me to use on my operation. Some others might be something like, as we look at these graphs and those animals are becoming much more similar, or those breeds are becoming more similar, does crossbreeding really have value to us? Are our breeds becoming too similar to the point that maybe that it doesn't work like we thought it did? And then maybe just other things such as that. And so as I think about that and bring those up, what I'd ask you to do is that I want this to be a learning experience. Hopefully you pick something up today that you can take home and learn a little bit more about, or you learn something here that maybe you need a little extra help with. There's plenty of people in the audience and around you that can help design a crossbreeding program, extension faculty from our land-grant universities and so on and so forth like that, allied industry representatives. So there's a lot of help out there. So I'd like you to think about who can I get help with and is this something that could really benefit me. But I want it to be a little bit of a learning experience for me too. And I don't really know why the reason is that we don't see more crossbreeding in the industry. And so as we get together tonight at the bullpen sessions, one thing that I'd like for you to do is that if you've considered crossbreeding and don't do it, I'd kind of like to know why that might be the case. Or if you did crossbreed for a while and you no longer do that, I'd kind of like to know that as well, because ultimately what that does for me and maybe some of my colleagues, that helps us to understand kind of your thinking a little bit and allows us maybe to put together programs and ideas and thoughts about how to get you to the next level and be able to take advantage of things such as crossbreeding. So as we go forward, think about some of those reasons, and as we get together tonight, please feel free to share some of those with me so that we might can work in your behalf. But as we think here about going forward and thinking about some systems, why isn't crossbreeding used more? I think one of the things is, again, as we looked at those graphs, the breeds are coming a little bit closer together. And I should have put the graph in here or the slide in here, but about 4 or 5, maybe 6 years ago now, there was some work done at the University of Nebraska, and they looked at kind of the level of heterosis today in some of these traits and the level of heterosis maybe in some of those generations early. And so we might think that maybe there's not as much heterosis as we once saw, but in fact the study that was done showed that in several of the traits, weaning weight, yearling weight, and maybe a couple of others, that what was found was there was at least as much heterosis generated today as there was, and in some cases even more. So as we look at those graphs or those figures, if that's a reason that we might not be crossbreeding, it really doesn't maybe stand true, because we can still make those kind of strides with the animals that are out there today and the breeds that are out there today. Another thing that sometimes is often mentioned is that if I use crossbreeding, I might kind of mongrelize my herd and not have very much uniformity. And the next slide here just shows kind of a little case that that's not really maybe the situation. So in this particular slide, what you see on the left or in the middle column is the coefficient of variation for purebred animals. And these purebred animals are the animals or the breeds that were used to produce these four breed composites over here on the right. And so as you look at those different traits and you look at those coefficients of variation, what you see is the variation in those purebred animals is really no different than what you see in those composites or in those crossbred animals. So if the concern is that we end up with more variation, then we definitely need to relook at this. So I'm going to end here pretty quick, and this is just a group of different types of systems. And in terms of systems, I think it's important to note that there's a number of systems and there are a lot of different, opportunities. There's different ways to take advantage of complementarity, different ways to take care of different levels of heterosis. And as a result of that, we need to pick a system that works for us and works for you and your situation. So there's always one that might fit, or if it doesn't completely fit your situation, then there's ways to adapt that and make it work so that you can take advantage of heterosis and breed complementarity. I know I'm just about out of time, so I just want to move kind of toward the end here and kind of look at one study. So as we think about this, there was a study that was done in California where over about a 10-year period, there was an Angus-based cow herd, and they continually used this in a commercial herd and bred back to Angus for about 10 years. And so they considered their cow herd an Angus cow herd. And so in this study, under a field trial, they then bred those cows randomly to either Hereford or Angus-type bulls. And so I'll just kind of look here. Year one, 400 cows, 10 breeds, 10 bulls each. Years two and three, 600 cows, 15 bulls of each breed. And so The reason I bring this up, sometimes we look at research studies and we get the numbers out of those research studies. The reason I put this in here today is that this is a situation that maybe some of you face. Maybe you have a vertically integrated opportunity where you have some alliances out there, and this was all done on a single operation, but maybe there's opportunities for you to do something similar. But they evaluated these animals, Angus-based cows, bred to Angus bulls or to Hereford bulls, and then they looked at ranch performance. And you can see here that in terms of the ranch performance, those Hereford-sired calves had an advantage of about $18. And that 15-pound difference that you see there is about a 3% direct heterosis for weaning weight, very similar to what you'd find in literature estimates. Then as you go to the next phase, feedlot and financial performance, and I don't have time to go through most or much of these, but if you just look here at the very bottom, total cost of gain and the break-even, those Hereford-sired calves had an advantage of $27.50 per head. So the last phase was the packing phase, and that's where we'll kind of end things today. But as you look there, in terms of carcass, you can see that those Angus-sired had a little bit of advantage there in terms of some of the traits and where they performed, and that was about a $15.6 advantage for the Angus. So putting all that together in kind of a very real-world experience where we have Angus-sired versus Hereford-sired calves on some Angus-based cows, you can see a difference, a value difference of about $30 per head. And so in addition to that, they also looked at the pregnancy rates of those Hereford-sired and Angus-sired females, and there was about a 7% difference, 93 versus 86% advantage to those Hereford-sired animals. So it's a little different study than maybe what you're used to hearing in a crossbreeding talk like this, but I think it's something that it's a system that maybe some of you are a part of. And maybe it just gives us an idea of how we can do something a little bit differently and take advantage of some heterosis and some breed complementarity. And so I know I'm just about out of time, so I think I'll stop there. And again, I'll just leave you with a little bit of a challenge. As you come to the bullpen sessions tonight, I'd really like to hear your input as to why maybe crossbreeding isn't used more readily in the beef industry, or maybe why you have some specific reasons why that might be the case. So with that...